seated. Good morning. Delighted to welcome you all for our first sitting of this new year. And we're especially delighted to welcome Prairie du Chien High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. These students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar and this court. We invite students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. If the students accept that invitation, they are given materials about the case we're about to hear. They may engage in some activities relating to the law or the case. They come for an oral argument, and at noon, after the second oral argument, the students meet with a justice who was assigned that day to meet with the students. The discussion at the noon hour is on the procedures of the court in accepting and deciding cases. The discussion is not on the substantive issues of the case, and everyone is invited to join the justice and the students at the noon hour. We have summaries of the case you're about to hear, the marshal does, and if you would raise your hand because you want a summary of the case, she will hand it out. Does anyone want a summary? All right. Let me introduce the court to you since we have met you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. You will meet with Justice Prosser at the noon hour. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Rogensack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call the first case, and that is 09AP2848, Lindy Orlowski versus State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company. And let me read the oral argument lineup to make sure we are in agreement. Mr. Goss, representing State Farm, has 25 minutes. Mr. Stachowiak. Representing Lindy Orlowski, 10 minutes for Edward E. Robinson, representing the Amicus Curiae, Wisconsin Association for Justice, and 5 minutes for Mr. Goss in rebuttal. Correct? All right. Mr. Goss.
May it please the court, this is an appeal of an underinsured motorist case from an arbitration decision. The issue involved is whether the collateral source rule applies to an underinsured motorist claim. And to give the court some assistance, hopefully, as to where I would like to go with the oral presentation, I would like to just very briefly comment on the scope of review, because this is a review of a arbitration panel's decision as opposed to a de novo review of a circuit court decision on this grazer question. I also would like to touch on the contractual provisions contained in State Farm's policy, which we contend would prohibit an insured such as Mr. Lowski in this case from recovering written-off medical expenses, which would be collateral source payments, by virtue of the anti-windfall provision contained in State Farm's policy. We've also stated that independent of the contractual provisions, she would not be entitled to recover these damages anyway by virtue of the fact that the collateral source rule does not apply to an underinsured motorist claim based on the holding in Grazer. But under State Farm's position, the dispositive issues on this appeal would be the scope of review, of the limited scope of review, which means that this court would necessarily share the view of the arbitration panel with respect to Grazer. That still would not warrant a reversal in this case, and by virtue, again, of our contractual provisions, which would, under typical circumstances, render the resolution of the Grazer question moot. And that's because, as the court noted in
the I can focus. What exactly contract provision are you relying on?
I'm talking about Clause B of State Farm's reducing provision, which indicates an insurer can only uncompensated damages only under the UIM coverage part. As a general rule, the court's resolution of one issue disposes the case. In that situation, court will not address additional issues. But in Hall, this court indicated that it will depart from that rule where the issue is of statewide importance, would be of assistance to judges, would be assistance to the parties involved, would provide clarity on a very important issue of law. We submit, Your Honor, that honors that this issue is very important. And we're asking the court, regardless of the handling of the other issues, to address the Grazer issue head on. The scope of the review of arbitration is limited, deferential, generally referred to as a hands-off approach. In this particular case, the circuit court believed that the arbitration panel demonstrated a manifest disregard of the law because, in the circuit court's view, it did not apply Grazer as the circuit court felt it should. As we'll be getting into it, but Grazer itself, the main take-home point found in paragraph one, is the collateral source rule does not apply to an underinsured motorist claim. That's it. And the arbitration panel in this case clearly, and we contend, properly applied that. But to constitute a manifest disregard of the law, it's clear that the panel would have to be found to have understood and correctly stated the law, but ignored it. Well, the panel in this case did anything but. They applied Grazer. They correctly, as we contend, reached the proper conclusion. But even if they didn't, it still would not constitute a manifest disregard of the law, so long as there's a rational basis to support the panel's decision.
Didn't the Grazer court wind up ultimately awarding the written-off medical expenses? And isn't that an internal inconsistency in Grazer that we need to address?
I will address that, but to get right to it, Your Honor, no. The court did not. One cannot say with certainty what the court did. The court in Grazer did award the insured the reasonable value of the medical expenses awarded, less the waived subrogation. That's really all it did in Grazer. Importantly, Your Honor, though, in that case, there was no claim made by Acuity or Heritage in that case that the waived written-off expenses would constitute a collateral source, which we contend clearly would. So that was never addressed in Grazer. But in this particular case, Orlowski is correct when she states that the arbitration panel in this case was limited under the contract to determination as, number one, whether the underinsured motorist is liable, if so, to what extent, number two, the amount of damages that would arise. And the panel would not be able, under the contract, to determine what State Farm's ultimate liability would be. I agree with that, and we agree with that as a general proposition. However, in this case, the parties expressly consented to have the arbitration panel decide Grazer, and that was submitted. And there's no mistake on that. That's clear from the record in the amended petitions and the answer that was, in fact, done. So we are on that issue limited to the court is required to have a deferential standard for review of that issue. And with respect
Mr. Goss, let me interrupt you on that point. We've got two relatively recent cases. Racine County is one. I think the Woodville School District is another where this court has looked at what are the proper circumstances to override an arbitration panel. And certainly it would appear to me, based on the language in those cases, that if the arbitration panel misinterpreted and misapplied the law, that that's a sufficient reason, as the circuit court found, to overrule or set aside the finding of the arbitration panel. You seem to be so limited in the scope of review that you're telling us about.
Right. I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because, again, Lukowski, and even in the cases you've cited, that mere errors of law, mere errors of facts themselves aren't enough. It has to be a manifest disregard of the law. And the only question that the arbitrators were asked to decide in this case was very limited, outside of just the general contractual provision, the standard arbitration provision, was the effect of Grazer on the award. That was done not to the circuit court, but to the arbitration panel.
But isn't that a key issue? If you, State Farm, as I understand it, specifically said to the arbitration panel, we want you to look at Grazer. We want you to discuss and decide Grazer. And assuming for a minute, I'm just assuming, that they got it wrong in regard to Grazer, isn't that the key? Isn't that the heart of the arbitration panel decision?
Well, it's a very important part, but as long as, Your Honor, there's a rational basis for its decision, then that's all that has to be done, because it's not de novo review. I mean, and, you know, and when it's decided. And I think part of the problems also arose with regard to the scope of the review. In other words, the contract, the arbitration panel cannot go beyond the contract in terms of what it can decide. Okay, but the Court of Appeals in its certification in this case said, the contract says this, and the arbitration panel should have gone and read the policy. By the way, they weren't given the policy, as shown in the record as well. They weren't asked to do that. And under Seid and Spender, they can't decide coverage terms absent an invitation from the parties to do so. This case, the review was very limited only to the effect of Grazer on the award. And again, Your Honor, I think that's a deferential standard. It is not a de novo standard. And our contention, though, Your Honor, is that the panel, in fact, did properly decide Grazer.
Counsel, if the arbitration panel was interpreting a statute rather than a case, and its interpretation was inconsistent with prior decisions of this court interpreting that statute, is it your position that we nevertheless have to defer to that incorrect interpretation of the law that's inconsistent with our decision of what the statute means? That's what I hear you arguing, and that seems a bit of an anathema to me.
Yeah, it isn't. I mean, the manifest disregard of the law in the cases say that basically it's where the panel understood and correctly stated the law, but ignored it, chose to ignore it. So it takes something more. It's not like, well, geez, you know, it's not what we would have done had we been deciding this issue. That isn't. It's the limited scope.
But I'm talking about not what we would have done if we decided the issue. In my question, I asked if we had already decided the issue, and yet they were asked to apply a statute, the issue being an interpretation of a statute, and they were asked to apply a statute and interpreted it inconsistent with our case law. Are we bound to uphold their interpretation that's inconsistent with our existing case law under your argument?
Well, if they, in fact, correctly stated the law, if I understand the court's question, and then ignored it, the court in that case could do it. But if it's again a rational basis where there's reasonable minds can differ, and the court or the arbitration panel decides in this case the application of Grazer in a particular way.
So there's. You know, there's something between ignore and the other end of the scale that we're talking about here. So it seems to be your, and I'm just trying to get the middle ground, not the far sides. It seems to be under your interpretation that if we have previously, if this court has previously issued opinions defining a statute, interpreting a statute, and a case comes before an arbitration panel, and they set out an argument that's rational, that's inconsistent with existing case law, but it's rational, they didn't ignore it. Are we bound to accept their interpretation of the statute that's inconsistent with existing case law?
In that case, I would say yes, Your Honor. I would, because of the deferential standard. And again, what gives finality to the process, what the parties have contracted for and agreed to do. In this particular case, with respect to Grazer, there's no question that the purpose of the collateral source rule is really grounded on two policies that's articulated very recently by this court in Fisher. First, to deter negligent conduct by placing the full cost of the wrongful conduct on the tortfeasor. Second, to allow the injured party and not the tortfeasor to benefit from a windfall that may arise as a result of the outside payment. And I submit that if there is going to be, if the collateral source rule does not apply, there will always be a windfall. That is, it is collateral source rule by nature overcompensatory. All right. But again,
it's okay. Court accepts that. I mean, that's part of the collateral source rule. You don't have to buy the collateral source rule, but
correct.
This court has.
Absolutely.
Right? But the real problem in collateral source rule is whether the tortfeasor is let off the hook.
Correct.
So your argument should be is this collateral source rule here has nothing to do with the tortfeasor.
Oh, the collateral source rule has everything to do with the tortfeasor, and that was the point in Grazer, because the collateral source rule applies to a tort claim, a negligence claim.
Of course. But who's going to pay these medical expenses in this case? I mean, you're arguing that your company should not pay them, right?
Right.
Are you going to collect back from the tortfeasor?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because subrogation was waived.
Okay. So the tortfeasor is never going to, is automatically left off the hook.
Correct. Based on the
who waived subrogation.
Correct.
Now, I just want to go
so
back.
Did that?
Pardon me? I said, who waived the subrogation? You did?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. But now you're complaining that the tortfeasor is going to be let off, has nothing to do with it, and is let off the hook. But you let him off the hook because you could have demanded subrogation. Now, you might not be able to get any money from him, but you never can tell. Life is long or short.
Right.
And but I want to make that point, but I also want to make the point that you argue that the parties expanded the arbitration to include Grazer. I just don't want to let that pass because the red brief of your opponent says that's not true. So we'll let him argue that, but he takes great issue with that. And I just want to get back to manifest disregard. You know, having sat on some of those cases, it's hard sometimes to tell mere error from manifest disregard, right?
Mm-hmm.
And here, and I think this was Justice Crooks's point of raising with you, isn't it manifest disregard when the arbitration panel relies on Grazer and doesn't look at any other cases that are subsequent to Grazer? I mean, I think that's what, if that wasn't Justice Crooks's point, it's mine.
No, it's mine as well. And,
our
case law basically has similar language to that effect, which I'll get to when you're finished.
Mm-hmm. Right. And when I can't say what the panel actually did in applying Grazer, but that was the argument. The focus of the argument in this case was Grazer, and that's right on the amended petitions, and answers, which join that issue as being being fact and what actually was done in this case. But in this case, the Grazer Court, and there's an old adage in the law that when the reason for the rule ceases, so should the rule itself. And that's really what I believe the court in Grazer recognized and acknowledged in reaching its conclusion that the collateral source rule cannot apply to an insured's claim against his or her own underinsured motorist. Why? Because the policy reasons of deterrence, punishment, and giving rise to a windfall, which are justified and based on our system of law, are compelled, simply do not apply in the case where you're making the claim against your own insurance carrier.
First, Mr. Goss, there are other purposes as well to the collateral source rule, not just deterrence of the tortfeasor. Another purpose that's discussed in the cases is full compensation for the injured party. Another purpose that's discussed is allowing the injured party the benefit of the premium paid. In other words, the insured, the benefit of the premium that was paid. So those are also, are they not, valid policy reasons when you look at the collateral source rule?
Yes, Your Honor, but as directed to the tortfeasor and not to your own insurer in a first-party claim like this. And that's the whole point. And I realize it could be difficult, and we've seen some courts that have struggled with that issue, because it is so ingrained that the collateral source rule applies. But you got to understand what is the underlying policy reasons supporting that rule. And as this court said in Fisher, public policy considerations, equitable considerations, do not lend themselves to black letter rules of law. You have to apply the standards, the public policies, to the facts of the case.
Let me, if I might, switch a little bit to the point that the chief was coming back to. I mentioned to you earlier in my questions the Racine County case, and here's a quote from the Racine County case. Arbitration awards, such as the one here, must be vacated when they conflict with governing law as set forth in the Constitution, a statute, or the case law. And one of the problems that I was having with your argument in regard to Grazer is just that, that apparently the arbitration panel stopped with that case and didn't go on to look at our case law in regard to the collateral source rule. Don't you see that as a problem?
No, because I don't, Your Honor, because I think the Grazer Court distinguished your case law largely in Kaufman, which is what it had at the time, and nothing's really changed since then. But the Grazer Court distinguished Kaufman, and I think correctly so. Because, again, the underlying, this is not a negligence action. This is a contract action, true, premised on, based on tort principles and, you know, in damages. But it's still one in contract. So, again, the underlying purpose for the collateral source rule simply can't apply. And again, it's a tendency to want to treat the State Farm in its capacity as the underinsured motorist carrier, same as the tortfeasor's liability insurer. And there are differences there. One case is directly linked to the tortfeasor. We're not. There are arguments that have been raised in this case that Grazer only applies to the situation where there's waived subrogation. The problem with that assertion, though, is there is nothing in the Grazer decision which states that. And indeed, Grazer never ruled that the collateral source rule applied to any other part of the claim. And with respect to Justice Gableman's earlier question, with respect concerning the issue of waived medical expenses, it really is unclear on the face of the opinion itself what that difference was. Was the plaintiff, injured party, liable, personally responsible for those? Were they subject to write-offs? Looking at the opinion, I can't say. But what I can say is that there was no discussion at all, no argument raised by Heritage in that case, saying that That's a collateral source, too, and it clearly is. This court has stated very clearly in Kaufman, again in Leininger, that waived medical expense does constitute a collateral source and is indeed deemed to be equivalent to a payment.
Counsel, maybe the manifest disregard of the law here has nothing to do with the case law, but that the arbitrators disregarded the policy language. And the policy language is very clear that says your company is going to pay the insured what the insured would have been legally entitled to recover from the tortfeasor. And under prior case law of this court, the injured party would be entitled to recover from the tortfeasor the reasonable value of the medical expenses, that is, the reasonable medical services, regardless of how much was actually paid to the medical personnel, right? So that's what your policy says. So the manifest disregard would seem to be arguably, hey, you never get to Glazer. You never get to anything else. You have to follow your policy. Now we get to the reduction clause.
Well, but the court, Your Honor, absent an invitation, or the arbitration panel, absent an invitation from the parties, is not entitled to look into the contractual terms. It can't. And Seidenspender tells us that if you, unless the contract so provides, it can't. That has to be addressed by a court of law. And so in this particular case, again, as cited in the brief, too, the panel never even had the insurance policy to look at, but even if they had the policy, it wouldn't have been its job to construe the policy in addressing the issue, absent an invitation from the parties, which clearly wasn't. So to the extent that the policy would provide coverage independent of Grazer, that would be a question of law, de novo.
The parties stipulated here that the approximately $61,000 difference between the billed amount and the paid amount was the product of insurance company write-offs.
Correct.
To be clear, what does that phrase write-off mean in the context of this case?
It means a discount. In other words, pre-negotiated rates where the insurance health insurance company deals with health care providers that agree to provide charges less than their, quote, standard billed rates.
So right. That money isn't sitting out there unbilled or written off by the...
No. Correct, Your Honor. Absolutely right. There's no liability on the part of Ms. Orlowski in this case whatsoever. And, again, she's not out one dime in terms of actual expense. And the court is right that from the standpoint of the measurement of, we're talking about medical expenses, which this case addressed, it's the reasonable value. Irrespective of whether those expenditures were actually made or the obligations were incurred. But again, that doesn't mean that they're actually sustained or that there is this obligation, which again dovetails with State Farm's requirement that the limits of recovery to uncompensated damages under the damages sustained but not recovered component in the reducing clause provision.
Three people who have an interest in the reasonable value versus actual payments are the tortfeasor, the injured party, and the injured party's insurance company, right?
Correct.
And your position is that the insurance company under the first person policy of uninsured gets the benefit of the discount.
In that case, against the tortfeasor.
And even though there's been a waiver of subrogation to the tortfeasor.
Even though there's been a waiver, Abraham, which again the Grazer Court acknowledged and distinguished. But again, that setting being the third-party negligence claim as opposed to the first-party UIM claim. That's the difference. And again, I think
Counsel, your red light's on. You have a moment to have a long sentence of summation. And then you get 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Sure. And again, provisions in State Farm's policy doesn't, we contend, change that, because it, largely because it is based on public policy considerations. And we cited the Burns case, which demonstrates that aptly in a situation where the insured did not have an exclusion for punitive damages, but the court realized that despite what the granting language was, the exclusion could not, or the award for punitive damages could not apply because the public policy of punishing the wrongdoer simply would not apply when you're making the claim against your own insurer, which is really the same rationale that the Grazer did, again, of deterrence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for Ms. Orlowski.
May it please the court. I want to take on that subject of the manifest error right off the bat. The way I see the arbitration cases, there are two types of complaints that can arise following an arbitration. Number one is where they decide something incorrectly on the merits, and that is the deferential standard of review. That's where that is applied. The one that we're dealing with here, and I think it's a different standard of review, is the one that's dealing with a contract type of violation. When the arbitrators get their assignment, it is from the contract. And the Baldwin-Woodville case that Justice Crooks mentioned, I'm not familiar with the Racine case, but there are a long line of cases going back, the Milwaukee Professional Firefighters case, Milwaukee Board of School Directors. They all seem to distinguish arbitration awards that stray from the contract. The arbitrator, they say that the arbitrators get their authority from the contract, and if they stray from that assignment, that is manifest error. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals, what the Court of Appeals found in its certification. I next want to address this business about waiver. Arbitration proceedings aren't on the record. They're very informal proceedings. You never know which way they're going to go. Our argument, like these arguments here, I guess, but our argument in the to the arbitrators was, number one, Grazer had no application here. We had a fallback argument. Even if you apply the Grazer case, Grazer allowed the recovery of those reduced medical expenses. So we had a two-pronged argument. The arbitrators took that, and they adopted the Grazer decision, and they didn't find what was required under the contract, which is what a tortfeasor would be responsible for. What this
contract are you talking about? The insurance policy contract or the contract for arbitration?
It's the insurance contract. The insurance contract. There was no separate arbitration contract. It was all based on the insurance. And yes, the arbitrators didn't have the policy, but these policies are pretty much the same. And these arbitrators do this all the time. They know what they're charged with.
Could I ask, this policy language about the amount of damages sustained but not recovered, and there's a similar thing. Is an insurance company entitled to take that language out?
Yes, I believe they could take that out if they desired. I don't think there's anything that requires it in the statute. But the purpose of that, I think, you have to look in the context of the entire policy. What the policy says is we will pay tort damages to our insured. We will pay what the insured would be reasonably entitled to collect from the underinsured driver. What is that? That's tort damages. So we're dealing with tort damages. When that policy says sustained but not recovered, what are they talking about? They're talking about tort damages that would be sustained. And not recovered means they're not getting it from the tortfeasor. It's greater than the policy limits of the tortfeasor. That's all that that means. And it comes into effect, for example, if you would have, say, a $100,000 policy with underinsured coverage, you would have a $50,000 tortfeasor policy, and you'd have $75,000 in tort damages. In the one case, you'd be reducing the policy limits, the $100,000. That would be sub A. You'd be reducing that $100,000 by what you received from the tortfeasor to get down to 50. Sub B deals with a situation where you are reducing your total damages, the $75,000, by the amount that you receive from the tortfeasor. So in one case, you're reducing it from the policy limits. In the other case, you're reducing it from the insured's total damages. But what you're reducing is what the tortfeasor had paid.
Let me ask this question. If State Farm had been representing the tortfeasor, and the tortfeasor had plenty of insurance, there's no limit here. As I understand Mr. Goss's argument, they wouldn't be arguing against the reasonable value of the medical.
I don't think they could.
They would have paid everything. I think what, as I understand, what he's saying is this is an insurance company not representing the tortfeasor, and they shouldn't be treated the same way as an insurance company that is representing the tortfeasor. You are saying, yes, they should. Now, give me the policy reasons why that is imperative.
Okay, number one. The number one policy reason is the language of their policy itself. What do, you know, probably hundreds of your cases dealing with insurance coverage say you look to the policy. What does the policy say? The policy says we will pay what you could collect from a tortfeasor, from the underinsured motorist. So, number one, it's enforcement of the policy. Number two, people expect when they buy underinsured coverage that they're purchasing coverage up to a limit that would put them in the same position as if the tortfeasor had adequate coverage. People expect that. And so that is fulfilling their expectation to award what would be awarded against the tortfeasor. The policy of making injured individuals whole, another important public policy that I think was used recently in the Fisher case. We want our insureds to be made whole for their damages. I'm sorry, it wasn't the Fisher case, it was the Canada case with the no pain and suffering under Canada law. So there are other policy reasons other than just punishment and deterrence. And if you look at the punishment and deterrence part of this, it kind of falls flat because State Farm wouldn't be punished if they were insuring a tortfeasor. They didn't do anything wrong. If we were going after a tortfeasor, if this was a third-party case, State Farm would be saddled under Kaufman, under Lightfist. They would be saddled with the reasonable value of those medical expenses, unreduced by waived or reduced amounts. They didn't do anything wrong. There's no deterrence there. It's the same situation in a first-party case where State Farm says, we will pay you, our insured, what you could recover against the underinsured driver. It's contractually purchased coverage either under the third-party scenario or the first-party scenario.
Counselor, how is making a party whole the responsibility of the injured person's insurance company rather than the responsibility of the tortfeasor who caused the harm?
Well, it's the responsibility of State Farm in this case because they sold that coverage. And when they sold that coverage, they said, we will pay damages that you'd be entitled to collect from an underinsured driver. So it is their problem.
I'm not focusing on the contract language. I'm focusing on the policy of a make-whole doctrine, which we have. And generally what we want to do is when someone is injured and somebody else is at fault, we want to make that person whole for the injury, but the obligation to do so initially lies with the tortfeasor, correct?
Of course.
And this case essentially transfers that obligation to the injured party's insurance company.
Yes, it does. I'm not sure I follow your statements, but...
Well, when we talked about make whole of an injured party, it was part of our doctrine that we wanted tortfeasors to make whole the injured person. And if the injured person had purchased insurance, which took that obligation from the tortfeasor, we didn't excuse the tortfeasor of his or her obligation to make whole. But it was the tortfeasor's obligation. Here, we're not saying there's any tortfeasor's obligation that the State Farm is having to pick up. We're saying they have the obligation to make whole in a primary sense, and that's what I'm wanting you to talk to me a little bit about. Why should we transfer that policy to the injured party's insurance company?
Well, there's several reasons. Number one, they waived their right to pursue the underinsured driver in this case, and they don't always do that. They're not required to do that. Number two, the entire body of tort law has been going away from the amount that was paid in favor of what is the reasonable value of those medical services that were provided. And that is the amount that would make the claimant whole. And that's what this court has held probably going back 90 or 100 years. It's the reasonable value of the medical services that were provided. And so, you know, the notion that...
You just think somebody's got to pay it. And if the tortfeasor's not paying it, then it's got to be the other insurance company, correct?
Correct, because they agreed to do so in their policy.
But if they're... Okay, all right, okay. Well, I think I understand. Thank you.
Isn't the problem here that we have what looks like a simple rule, collateral source? And we have a number of cases that come up under a whole variety of fact situations. And the collateral source rule has a number of policies, public policies or basic underlying concepts. And they all don't quite fit together in any particular fact situation.
Okay.
And that when you look at these cases, in one case, the concept that a windfall should go to the injured party seems to take precedence. In another case, the concept that the injured party not get a windfall and that the tortfeasor isn't going to be affected one way or another, so you apply a rule that says, hey, look at the actual expenses. And that these public policies that you set forth about the language of the policy, the expectation of the victim, the make injured person whole. It's hard to argue that this injured person hasn't been made whole. This injured party got all the expenses that he incurred, right? And pain and suffering, right?
I wouldn't agree that those were incurred, but. The damage occurred.
He got everything that he was out of pocket, plus pain and suffering.
Yes.
So he is, quote, under one definition of made whole, he's out nothing. If you give him the reasonable value of the medical services, he's winding up with all expenses paid, pain and suffering, plus, what is it, 60 grand?
Yes.
Hey, I'd like to be made whole that way every day.
Well, the trouble with that is that Mrs. Orlowski paid those premiums for her health insurance for many years, and she paid the State Farm. So this isn't a windfall.
She ought to get that back in this form.
Because, yes.
And not the auto company, the insurance company, or the tortfeasor, right?
Correct. And I guess I would liken it to a life insurance policy. If you buy a high enough life insurance policy, you buy a $1 million policy, and you die, somebody could argue that your widow was overcompensated. But it doesn't work like that because you are purchasing that coverage. When you purchase the coverage, it's not overcompensated. It's not a windfall. That's my belief. If she purchases coverage, that's going to apply for the health insurance and then the underinsured coverage, she ought to get that.
Do you think it matters whether the insurance company waives subrogation or not?
No, it shouldn't. It shouldn't. That's a business decision that they're making on their behalf.
If that made a difference, you would have an anomaly in result. It seemed to me that if they waive it, then they get the benefit of the extra money. But if they don't waive it, therefore the tortfeasor is still on the hook, then the normal rules of collateral source under torts applies. So it doesn't seem like it can take, they waived it here. Had they not waived it, the tortfeasor would still be on the hook.
Correct, correct. And I'm all for some consistency in this area of the law, which, I am seeing some inconsistencies here. If you look at, if you were going to interpret Grazer to apply very narrowly to where an insurance company has waived its lien, that's going to conflict with another case of this court, which is the Anderson versus Garber decision. And so even if you construe this Grazer case narrowly, it's inconsistent with prior decisions of this court. And I think straight out, Grazer just needs to be overruled.
Well, can it be interpreted?
I don't think so, because of that one clarified, I guess. But even if it's very limited to the certain facts where an insurance company waives it, you still then have problems with that Anderson decision, which is it's pretty much right on point where the health insurer waived it. The insured in that case was allowed to make the recovery for the waived amounts. So the bottom line is if I were writing this decision, it would be in three separate subsections. Where the arbitrators made undisputed findings of fact that the plaintiffs, that the reasonable value of the medical services necessitated as a result of the accident are $72,000. The plaintiff is entitled to those damages, whether it's from a tortfeasor, whether it's from an uninsured motorist carrier or underinsured motorist carrier. Number two, Grazer is overruled to the extent that it treats underinsured motorist coverage or uninsured motorist coverage differently from traditional tort claim purposes, at least for purposes of the collateral source rule. I would then reject State Farm's argument that the sustained but not recovered language applies here. This is number one. It's an attempt to reduce the coverage by something which is not allowed under the statute. 632.32 allows reduction for three things: amounts paid by the tortfeasor, amount paid by workers' comp, amount paid by disability insurance company. It doesn't provide for an amount to be reduced by written off medical expenses. Beyond that, the sustained but not recovered language is very vague when it comes to be applied to medical bills. I don't believe that was the purpose of that language in there, and it shouldn't be interpreted as such.
Could I ask this reasonable value of medical services, does that vary depending on what health care institution you go to?
Sure. I think all hospitals have their own rates. They set their own rates. Doctors set their own rates as to what their charges are. It's a mystery to me, and I think to most people, how they set it, but yeah, it varies.
Okay. If the victim of a tortfeasor is smart enough to buy uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage at a high amount, something I would recommend to everyone, you get to pick the Mayo Clinic where you go to be treated.
The most expensive.
And if the tortfeasor's insurance doesn't cover it, your insurance will cover it, irrespective of the cost. If it's reasonable according to that institution. Is that good policy?
Is it good policy that we allow that the reasonable value? I mean, there's ways of challenging that. If it's ridiculously high, for example, expert testimony is allowed to challenge that. It has to be reasonable. And so is there a risk that it's going to be sky high? Sure, but that's not set in stone. It's something that can be challenged. Is it good policy to allow plaintiffs or injured parties to recover the reasonable value of the medical expenses? Your Honor, I think that's been the law for 90 years or more, and it's constantly been rejected that we're not going to deal with the bills, what was actually paid. And, it is a longstanding policy of this court, and it is a good one, I think.
Could I ask you one other question? I think your opposing counsel Let's see, what was my question? Your opposing counsel said that the arbitrators were really not focusing at all and weren't permitted to focus on the language of the State Farm policy. And your rebuttal to that is?
They weren't permitted. I mean, that's how they get their assignment. Their assignment under that policy says arbitrators are to find whether the injured party is, or I'm sorry, whether the underinsured motorist is liable, and if so, in what amount. And that's fairly standard language throughout the policy, throughout various underinsured policies. So, you know, they're charged with just those two findings. It doesn't say anything about the amount that would be collected against State Farm. It says the amount that the tortfeasor would be responsible for, by the underinsured motorist would be responsible for. So that language, the charge to the arbitrators telling them what to do, is it virtually mimics the coverage clause of the underinsured endorsement. They're the same. Is the underinsured motorist liable, and if so, in what amount? So, you know, that's their charge. That's a fairly common thing that we see in these arbitration proceedings. Thank you. I see my red light is on.
The red light's on, too. If you have another long sentence, I'll let you do it. If you're done, that's fine, too. You don't have to feel obligated.
I'll quit while I'm ahead, I think.
All right, counsel. Mr. Robinson, representing Wisconsin Association for Justice. You filed an amicus brief.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. On behalf of the Wisconsin Association for Justice, I'm grateful that I have a few minutes this morning to address the issues in this case. The Wisconsin Association for Justice did participate at the Court of Appeals level by filing a brief, and we also filed a brief here with your honors. We do not take a position other than joining in the position of Orlowski with respect to the procedural issues about standard of review and whether the arbitrators engaged in manifest disregard of the law. We join in their arguments. But we focus now on the issue of the Heritage Mutual Insurance Company versus Grazer decision, which has been on the books now for almost a decade. It came out in April of 2002. And over that almost 10 years since the Grazer decision has come out, interestingly, it's never been cited by the Court of Appeals or this court or any court in any other jurisdiction for any proposition, even a single time. Nevertheless, insurance companies like State Farm in this case, who provide uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage, have taken language out of the Grazer decision, cherry-picked it, broad language, out of context. And so now we have a situation where the Grazer decision has been separated, divorced from its very narrow factual and procedural moorings, and unfortunately, if allowed to continue by this court, it's going to allow the case to be sent adrift in a sea of absurd results. We cataloged for your honors in our amicus curiae brief appendix a collection of circuit court decisions because there has been no subsequent appellate court guidance from the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court about Grazer. These circuit courts have been left to try to grapple with what exactly this Grazer decision is all about and to what extent does it apply beyond the very specific situation addressed in that case, which was where a subrogated party that has a valid lien chooses to waive a portion of its lien. That was the issue in Grazer. Justice Gableman asked a question of counsel for State Farm in this case. Didn't the Court of Appeals in Grazer allow the plaintiff in that case to recover as part of the reasonable value of medical expenses, write-offs, and discounts? I submit to you that it is an absolute fact, as much as the earth is round and not flat, that the earth revolves around the sun and not the other way around, that did in fact happen in the Grazer case. The result was the plaintiff in that case was allowed to recover write-offs and discounts. You can review footnotes 3 and 4 of the decision. If there were still any lingering doubts, I would invite your honors or your clerks to go and read, excuse me, the party's briefs that were submitted to the Court of Appeals in Grazer. And curiously, you'll find an admission in the brief submitted on behalf of Heritage in that case. Among other things, you'll find a concession in that case, in that brief, that the plaintiff was allowed to recover write-offs and discounts under the Court of Appeals decision in Kaufman. They did allow the plaintiff to recover write-offs and discounts, which is one of the internal inconsistencies with the Grazer decision. And so we have the Court of Appeals in Grazer, long before this court last term decided Fisher, actually reached a result that could be upheld. And, in fact, our position may differ slightly from counsel for Orlowski's position in that the Wisconsin Association for Justice is not here asking the court to necessarily overrule Grazer in its entirety. Instead, we believe that Grazer can be given a narrow interpretation consistent with this court's decision in Fisher last term that would harmonize the Grazer decision with existing law while preserving the contractual right of Orlowski and similarly situated people that purchase underinsured motorist coverage to get the benefits that they pay for. And that narrow interpretation is this. Last term, Your Honors had before you the Fisher decision, and the issue there was American Family wasn't a health insurance company, it was an auto company. It was the plaintiff's own company, had paid $10,000 in MedPay. They decided to go to arbitration to try to recover that from, I believe it was Wilson Mutual, it doesn't matter, from the tortfeasor's insurance company. Unfortunately, they lost at arbitration. That $10,000 MedPay claim was lost. However, the plaintiff filed a lawsuit against the tortfeasor and the tortfeasor's insurance company and prevailed at trial. The issue then was, of the total amount of the medical expenses, and the number escapes me, does the plaintiff get to recover the $10,000? That was the subrogated claim. American Family, who had paid that, they had participated. They weren't on the sidelines like the insurance company in Radloff or the insurance company in Anderson versus Garber that sat back and did nothing despite having an opportunity to participate. American Family participated but lost the lien, and the court held that the plaintiff was not allowed to recover that amount. That $10,000 did not revert to the plaintiff. And part of the reason there was that the plaintiff, if allowed to keep the $10,000 they got from American Family, because there's no subrogation claim anymore, that amount's not going to have to be paid back to American Family. If allowed to keep that $10,000 and then recover that $10,000 again from the tortfeasor, there would be a double recovery. Grazer can be harmonized with the court's decision in Fisher. And that, based on the facts of Grazer, we have a situation where the insurance company apparently did participate, was involved in the discussions with the liability carrier, agreed to take part of its lien back but waive the additional amount. So consistent with Fisher, this court can say that Grazer applies to a situation where the plaintiff's health insurance company or auto company with a MedPay claim, I suppose, where the subrogated claim is waived in whole or in part, that doesn't revert to the plaintiff, to the insured. However, the remaining amount of the reasonable value of the medical expenses is still the claim that belongs to the insured. And let me jump off right there and talk about the prior decisions of this court. As counsel has indicated, the rule with respect to how do you evaluate or put a value on medical expenses has been established for a long, long time. And the measure of damages is the reasonable value of medical care. In some cases, that may consist of payments made by a subrogated party. So we start out, imagine we have a whole pie in front of us. One slice of the pie may be composed of payments that a subrogated party made, a health insurance company made. Another portion of the pie may be payments that the insured has paid out of his or her own pocket, co-pays, deductibles, and this ever changing world of health insurance, it seems the deductibles go up every year, premiums go up every year. So another piece of the pie would be deductibles and co-pays. Another piece of the pie would be write-offs and discounts. Now, this court, starting with Ellsworth, going into Kaufman, and more recently in Leidinger, have established that the measure of damages in a tort action is you get to recover with respect to medical expenses. You are made whole when you recover the reasonable value of those medical expenses. And the reasonable value consists of all of those categories that I just discussed, payments made by a subrogated party, payments you've made out of your own pocket, maybe outstanding bills that haven't been paid, and write-offs and discounts. And this court, the kind of the public policy behind Kaufman and Leininger, was that the measure of damages should be the same and should not turn on such variables as what health insurance do you have? Do you have health insurance? Whether there are write-offs or not. We're not being asked in this case, the Council for State Farm has not asked this court to go back and revisit the rule of damages in tort actions for medical expenses. That's not before the court. In fact, I would add that since the time of Orlowski's accident, the legislature has stepped in and codified now this court's decisions in Kaufman and Leininger in a statute that now says 908.03.6MBM that the amount billed is presumed to state the reasonable value of the care. Amount billed, not amount paid or what you have to pay back. So we're starting here with a contract that says we will pay all damages our insured is legally entitled to collect from the tortfeasor. The Court of Appeals in Grazer took a wrong turn. I'm reminded of the song by Bruce Springsteen, took a wrong turn and kept going when it said a UIM claim is a contract claim. The collateral source rule is a tort doctrine. Therefore, there's no place or room for the collateral source rule in a UIM claim. Well, that's just flawed reasoning. The starting point, as this court has made clear, when you're determining the extent of benefits available under any type of a insurance policy is with the terms of the policy itself. I see my time is up so quickly. In the policy, State Farm agreed to pay the damages its insured was entitled to collect from the tortfeasor. As this court said in Gillette, or Gillette, depending on if they're related to the razor company business, in Gillette or Gillette, this court made it clear that in an underinsured motorist contract where the language says you're entitled to recover, we will pay the damages you're legally entitled to collect from the underinsured motorist, that what that language is doing clearly and unambiguously is adopting Wisconsin tort rules for the measure of damages. So what I'm asking this court to do on behalf of the Academy is to issue a decision that will withdraw any language in the Grazer decision to the extent that the collateral source rule does not apply in an underinsured motorist context that was broader than necessary, broader than the issue at hand. And if I had more time, I would give you my top 10 list of the horrible results that would happen, including if the collateral source rule does not apply, where does it go next? Wage loss, where your employer continue to pay you? Life insurance in a death case. If truly the court is going to say the collateral source rule does not apply in a UIM case, that's what's going to happen next. And the unintended and absurd consequence of that is the person who is responsible and goes out and pays premiums to get health insurance coverage, to get life insurance coverage, to get all sorts of coverages to protect themselves, are put in a far worse position than the person that lives in a van down by the river that doesn't do anything to protect himself or his family by purchasing additional coverages. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Goss.
Briefly, Your Honor, Mr. Orlowski's attorney raised a number of points about why the collateral source rule should apply in a UIM context. One was to enforce the policy as written. And while we acknowledge that that's a starting point in terms of what damages may be required, it's important, again, to keep in mind the underlying policy reasons supporting imposition of the collateral source rule. And the only thing that's being turned around here is that because it's a contract action, the basis, fundamental basis for the collateral source rule, the public policy reasons supporting it don't apply like they would in a tort.
In regard to the contract, opposing counsel said that your reducing clause is not in compliance with 632.32. Would you address that, please?
It is not a reducing clause that's addressed by statute. The statutory reducing clause reference can be found in Part A of that that provision, which talks about reductions of limits. An insurer in Wisconsin underwriting UIM policies can only reduce from its limits those items, liability payments, workers' comp payments, social security payments, as a reduction. As this court noted in Bailey, sub B is not a reducing clause. It is a anti-windfall provision, which indicates that the limits the recovery only to uncompensated damages. And that's really, after all, what we're talking about here, is that Ms. Orlowski, in this case, has been effectively compensated by the write-offs. It's no different than the wave subrogation.
Okay, so what you're saying is that he just looked at the wrong provision of 632.32, and what you are doing isn't inconsistent with the statute?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Okay. And again, this court in Bailey noted that and distinguished the two sections of that that provision. The argument is made that by applying the collateral source rule, Ms. Orlowski is going to be made whole. Again, we reject that. Anytime the collateral source rule applies, especially in a situation like this, a classic one, the person entitled to it is going to be made more than whole. More than whole. And again, she's not out one penny, and nor should she be in this case. And again, it amounts to a windfall on her part. And we hear counsel argue that that in Leidinger, the court said that the award of reasonable value of medical expenses is necessary to make the injured party whole. Again, in the tort context. But even when you look at that, it's made whole, this court in Leidinger, in referring to its holding in Kaufman, had quotation marks over made whole, with the understanding being that made whole for tort purposes definitely being made more than whole when you're talking about the inapplicability of the collateral source.
Mr. Goss, towards the end of his presentation, Mr. Robinson used two examples to sort of illustrate a slippery slope argument. Life insurance was one, and I don't remember the other right off the top of my head, but I wonder if you would address that argument.
Sure. I think, not having all the hypotheticals in mind, I suppose a disability payment, Your Honor, could be a collateral source rule, would be very, and therefore wouldn't apply in the recovery in this case, just like wave subrogation. Insurance, life insurance policy, that would depend, again, on the facts. And I think, as I recall in their brief, they're talking about a wrongful death claim. Well, life insurance goes to the deceased and the beneficiaries. It has nothing to do with the damages that the person asserting the wrongful death claim would be. And again, to be a collateral source rule, it still has to relate to the payment made by at issue, Your Honor.
Counsel, under 632.32... and that's what your opposing counsel was referring to, the reducing clause, that you can't have a reducing clause. No policy may provide that the limits under the policy for uninsured motorist or underinsured motorist coverage for bodily injury shall be reduced by any of the following. Number one, amounts paid by or on behalf of, et cetera. Number two, workers' comp. Number three, disability benefits. You said, no, you weren't relying on that. You are relying on something else. What is the cite to what you're relying on?
What I'm relying on is the court's decision in Bailey, and what the court justice is looking at is the current statute, or no longer current. It's from 09 to 2011, where reducing clauses were deemed invalid. Our case, we are dealing with valid reducing clauses. So I'm talking about the pre 09 section 632.32 sub 5 sub I.
I'm going to ask you a question I asked you before. What provision in the policy are you relying on? I'm looking at your appendix. Yes. Page. Pardon me? Okay, that's what I'm looking for. Tell me what the language is on 146 of your sentence.
The most we will pay will be the lesser of limits of liability of this coverage reduced by any of the following that apply. And again, you're right, to Justice Bradley's question, that has to do with the reducing clause, which in our context, that is valid. But B said, or the amount of damage is sustained but not recovered. And that is that section B. And by that, as this court noted in Bailey, that B section is basically a provision telling the insured that State Farm will only pay uncompensated damages. So again, the provision.
He wasn't compensated for the $60,000.
Well, she might as well have been. I mean, I don't think there's any difference, and I reject the difference that there's somehow a distinction where there's a waiver of subrogation,
okay,
where they, as opposed to where you're not charged for it in the first place. I mean, the insured is the same place. There's a windfall to the insured, which again, in the tort context, is permissible, but okay, shouldn't be applied.
Ms. Orlowski's counsel makes the argument, though, that by dint of the payment of premiums over the years, that would not actually be a windfall for her. Please.
Right. And I would defer to Professor Dobbs addressing that point, which we referenced in our brief, where this court referred a lot to him in the Leidinger case, that basically the purpose of obtaining UIM coverage is for security, and really to get actual recovery. It's not to get windfall damages. And Professor Dobbs also notes that by allowing that to take place, everybody pays more in terms of higher premiums and the like, which is also the point that the Burns Court noted with regard to allowing recovery for punitive damages against one's own insurer. And in this particular case, as the Heritage, as the Grazer Court noted, that the payment that Ms. Orlowski received from State Farm covers exactly what she contracted for, compensation for actual damages, and actual damage is important, without consideration of the collateral source rule. And that's all we're asking in this case. We believe this is the policy the court should apply. It's fair. It's balanced. It's fair to all parties, as it must be. And this court is the ultimate arbitrator of public policy and should apply a policy that would be best suited for all involved.
Thank you, counsel. On behalf of the court, I want to thank all counsel who have presented briefs and oral argument today for yet another case that involves interpretation of insurance policies, the effect of arbitration, and the collateral source rule, which seem to be three areas of the law that we deal with some frequency. So I want to thank you all for your excellent presentations in helping the court decide this case. So ends our oral argument in 09-AP-2848, Orlowski versus State Farm Mutual Auto Insurance Company. The court will take a few moments of recess to allow the Prairie du Chien students to leave if they wish and allow other students to enter the chambers. We are in recess.